Now on there. The recitation of articles that are available in open access journals. These documents are freely available on the internet. Be sure to visit the site of the journal for more information. Enjoy. Does it work? The Unforeseeable Consequences of Quasi-Phelan Technology by Federica Flabetti from Culture Machine. Culture Machine Vol. 112010. Does it work? The Unforeseeable Consequences of Quasi-Phelan Technology. Federica Flabetti. Monsters vs. Aliens. Fighting an alien robot. That was me. And it was amazing. Boasts Susan Murphy, soon after having defeated an alien robot probe in San Francisco with the help of a gelatinous blue blob and a gay fish-ape hybrid. She gleefully proceeds to enumerate all the different ways in which being a monster is an extremely appealing and rewarding status for an American girl of her age. All the while, the group of freaks that surround her, which includes a mad scientist and a perambulating insect chrysalis, marvel at the discovery of their own virtues and talents. I want to offer a brief reading of the computer-animated 3D feature film from DreamWorks Animation and Paramount Pictures, Monsters vs. Aliens, as a kind of anticipation of the argument of this article. In this film released in March 2009, Susan Murphy, a young woman from Modesto, California, is hit by a radioactive meteor on the day of her wedding, thus absorbing a rare substance called quantonium, which mutates her into a gentis. Immediately captured by the US military and classified as a monster, she is imprisoned in a top-secret facility headed by General W.R. Munger, where other monsters are also kept in custody. Among them are B.O.B. Bicarbonate Acetylene Benzonate, an indestructible gelatinous blue blob without a brain doctor. Cockroach Ph.D. A mad scientist with a giant cockroach's head, the missing link, a 20,000-year-old amphibious fish-ape hybrid, and Insectosaurus, a 350-foot grub. When an alien named Galaxar attacks Earth with his gigantic robotic probes and an army of clones of himself, General Munger persuades the President of the United States to deploy the monsters as military weapons. Having accepted the mission with the promise of freedom if they succeed, the monsters manage to destroy the alien. www.culturemachine.net 107 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Robotic probe that Galaxar has sent to San Francisco. During the fight, Susan discovers that she possesses an unexpected strength, and that she is also invulnerable to Galaxar's weapons. Having been freed, Susan happily returns to Modesto, only to be rejected by her fiancé, who claims that he cannot be married to a woman who overshadows him. In the meantime, her monstrous friends unwittingly cause panic in the neighborhood. Initially sad and dispirited, Susan suddenly realizes that becoming a monster has actually enriched her life, and she fully embraces her new amazing lifestyle and her newly formed bond with other monsters. After a final epic fight, Susan and her gang completely defeat Galaxar and his cloned army, and are eventually acclaimed as heroes. In the last scene of the film, they are alerted to the fact that in the surroundings of Paris, a snail has fallen into a nuclear power plant and is grown into a giant due to nuclear irradiation. They then fly off on a mission to protect Earth from the new enemy. What is particularly interesting about Monsters vs. Aliens is that in this movie, the monsters function first and foremost as a figure of the unexpected consequences of technology. Not only do they all come into existence as the unpredictable outcomes of experiments gone wrong, B.O.B. was mistakenly created by injecting a genetically modified tomato with a chemically altered ranch dressing. Dr. Cockroach ended up with an insect head and the ability to climb walls while subjecting himself to an experiment in order to gain the longevity of a cockroach. Insectosaurus, originally a 1-inch grub, was transformed into a giant after being accidentally invested by nuclear radiation, and while the mad scientist is the figure of the experiment gone wrong par excellence, even the missing link could not have been found frozen in a lagoon and thought out by scientists without some help from technology. One even more importantly, the monsters are also domesticated, or rather, they are kept under custody by the American government and later transformed into weapons. In other words, the film seems to imply that technology needs to be controlled in order to be made useful, that is, it has to be made into a tool. Nevertheless, in order to be successfully deployed as weapons, monsters must be released from custody, or in order to be used, technology must be set free. Yet once it is set free, technology seems to escape its own instrumentality. Indeed, it is by fighting Galaxar that Susan discovers her unexpected physical strength, while during the final battle against aliens, Insectosaurus apparently dies, only to undergo a metamorphosis from a chrysalis into a beautiful www.culturemachine.net 108 for Betty. Does it work? CM1120100. Butterfly. Ultimately, though, the monsters are still kept under control. They constitute an American military team, albeit a very special one. It is here that aliens find their place in the film narrative. A relationship which would otherwise be quite uncomplicated. Humans detain and domesticate dangerous monsters finds its third term in the aggressive threat from the outside. Aliens provide an enemy and help construct the narrative of the American fight for democracy against alien totalitarian regimes. Even though it occasionally makes fun of the American government, General W.R. Munger's name is a pun on the word warmonger, and the NEP President of the United States is always on the verge of launching a nuclear attack by pressing the wrong button, the film still embraces a narrative that legitimates the United States as the world superpower. 2. However, the most interesting point of the film is to be found at the end. In the final scene, the monsters set off to Paris to fight a gigantic snail which has broken into a nuclear plant. But should the snail be perceived as an alien or a monster? Since it is presented as a threat against which the monsters are supposed to fight, it must be an alien. And yet, since clearly it is an unexpected effect of technology, actually, accidental nuclear irradiation is one of the most common origin stories of superheroes and is very similar to Insectosaurus' story, the snail must be a monster, and in principle it should not be fought, but rather helped out, or maybe even recruited, as part of the team. With a revealing lapse, a Wikipedia entry, http://n.wikipedia.org/wiki/monsters_versus_aliens, recounts how at the end of the film, the monsters are alerted to monster attack near Paris and fly off to combat the new menace, Italics Mine. In Derridean terms, it could be said that the snail is the incest taboo of monsters versus alien, the locus where the distinction between monsters and aliens becomes untenable. It is the point of opacity of the film, or the point where the film narrative undoes itself. 3. But why is it important to think about the untenability of the distinction between monsters and aliens, and ultimately, about the distinction between usable, domesticated functioning technology, on the one hand, and failing unpredictable technology, or technology out of control, on the other? What I want to argue in this article is that an usability failure and the capacity for generating unexpected consequences are in fact constitutive of technology. Indeed, technology cannot exist without failure. It cannot be separated from its constitutive fallibility, which importantly also drives its growth. Yet technology also exists only. www.culturemachine.net 109 for Betty. Does it work? CM1120100. Inasmuch as such a separation is continually reasserted even though it keeps becoming undone. What is more, I want to argue that the failure of technology is tightly connected with the concept of instrumentality. Commonsensically, failing technology is a technology that does not work, or that does not work as expected. In doing so, technology escapes its own conception as an instrument, a tool which we can use, control and master. In other words, it exceeds its own instrumentality and gives rise to the unpredictable. And yet, It is precisely the capacity of technology, for not welcome that is, for generating unexpected consequences, that ultimately makes it possible for technology to work. Moreover, as I will show in a moment, every failure requires a decision in order to be constituted as a failure, that is, a decision about what behaviors are considered expected or acceptable for a given instantiation of technology. From a technical point of view, failure, that is, a malfunction, is something that needs to be fixed. However, there exists widespread recognition in media and cultural studies that a rethinking of contemporary technology is needed today. For those of us who want to think about technology differently by asking different questions of technology from the technical ones, perfectly functioning technologies might not be the most interesting ones to look at. Indeed, I want to argue here that technology is at its most revealing precisely when it does not work, or even better, when it isn't clear to common users, and even to technical experts, whether it is working or not. I call these moments, which occur more frequently than one might think at first glance, quasi-failures, and these instances of technology, quasi-failing technologies. I will discuss some examples of failing and quasi-failing technologies in the further parts of this article, in order to show to what extent and in what way they can contribute to a different cultural and political understanding of technology. What is at stake in this discussion is ultimately the possibility of a non-functionalist engagement with technology. I am thus posing two questions. Can we say something about technology that is not an explanation of how it does or does not work? Can we give a non-functionalist answer to the question, what does technology do? These questions are extremely important for the investigation of what are commonly named new or digital technologies in the field of media and cultural studies. When approaching new technologies, media and cultural studies has predominantly focused on the intertwined processes of production, reception, and consumption, that is, on the discourses and practices of new technologies. www.culturemachine.net/110flabetti. Does it work? CM112010. Producers and users. From this perspective, even a technological object as mysterious as software is addressed by asking how it has been made into a significant cultural object. For instance, in his 2003 article in Software, Adrian McKenzie demonstrates the relevance of software as a topic of study, essentially by examining the new social and cultural formations that surrounded McKenzie, 2003. An analogous claim is made by Levmanovich in his recent book, Software Takes Command, 2008, where while arguing that media studies has not yet investigated software itself, and advancing a proposition for a new field of study that he names software studies, Manovich is actually adamant that software studies should focus on software as a cultural object, or in Manovich's own terms, as another dimension in the space of culture. Manovich, 2008. 4. Software becomes culturally visible only when it becomes visual, namely, a medium and therefore the new engine of culture. 4. On the other hand, when addressing the workings of technology, cultural investigations of new technologies tend to draw on the explanation of how a specific instance of technology functions, as it can also be found in technical literature. See, for instance, Galloway, 2004. Although I recognize that the above perspectives remain very important and politically meaningful for the cultural study of technology, I suggest that they should be supplemented by an alternative, or I would even hesitantly say more direct, investigation of technology. I want to argue that it is possible to engage in a closer, even intimate relationship with technology by focusing on the capacity of technology to generate the unexpected. Such cautious intimacy would also be crucial in developing a political understanding of technology. It would still aim at demystifying technology and at dispelling what Bernard Stiegler has called its opacity. Stiegler, 1998, in order to make contemporary technology thinkable, thus ultimately enabling us to make decisions about technologies that increasingly escape our understanding. And yet such an approach would remain aware of the fact that our access to technology is always mediated. It would definitely not assume that technology can be made totally transparent. It would also keep questioning the very nature of our intimate engagement with technology itself. In order to do further such an alternative understanding of technology, I want to start here by looking at what is possibly the least accessible yet most pervasive of digital technologies, the one we commonly refer to as software. Firstly, I want to explore in what way software's fallibility was perceived by the emerging discipline of software engineering at the end of the 1960s precisely. www.culturemachine. Net 111 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. When the term software was becoming popular both within and without the technical realm. Secondly, I want to examine how, starting from the second half of the 1990s, such fallibility has been put to work in the open source movement. Calculating the unforeseeable in the Cold War years, the discipline of software engineering emerged as a strategy for the industrialization of the production of software at the end of the 1960s. The first two conferences in software engineering were convened by the NATO Science Committee in 1968 and 1969 in Garmisch, Germany, and Rome, Italy, respectively. They involved all the so-called founding fathers of software engineering, the well-known computer scientists of the time, such as Edsger W. Dijkstra and Peter Knorr, dealt with many of the topics that still constitute the agenda of software engineering today, and were accurately documented through the publication of detailed proceedings. These two conferences, especially the one held in Garmisch, are considered the founding moment of software engineering as both an academic discipline and a methodology for software production. Actually, the Garmisch conference report can be thought of as the foundational narrative for the field. What I want to propose in what follows is that in the late 1960s, software engineering established itself as a discipline precisely through an attempt to control the constitutive fallibility of software-based technology. For, historically, software engineering emerged from a crisis, the so-called software crisis of the late 1960s. For instance, during the Garmisch conference, Dijkstra reportedly stated that (THE) general admission of the existence of the software failure and this group of responsible people is the most refreshing experience I have had in a number of years, because the admission of shortcomings is the primary condition for improvement. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969 121. Terms such as software crisis and software failure were largely used at the NATO conferences on software engineering, and for this reason many of the participants view that conference as a turning point in their way of approaching software and in their work. www.culturemachine.net 112 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. In the field. Indeed, with the NATO conferences, software began to be conceptualized as a problem, and the software crisis was constituted as a point of origin for the discipline of software engineering. From the very beginning, the participants in the Garmisch conference acknowledged that they were dealing with a problem crucial to the use of computers, viz. The so-called software, or programs, developed to control their action. Or ampersand Randell, 1969. 3. The very first lines of the Garmisch report establish a clear relationship between software and control, while at the same time characterizing this relationship, as well as software itself, as problematic. But why was software problematic in the late 1960s? The problems that the Garmisch conference attempted to address were mainly related to large, or very large, software systems, that is, systems of a certain complexity, whose development required a conspicuous effort in terms of time, money, and the number of programmers involved. 5. As Randell comments in his recollections about the Garmisch conference thus explaining NATO's interest in software engineering, it was the US military industrial complex that first started to try and develop very large software systems involving man millennia of effort. Randell, 1979. 5. Randell also mentions a paper presented by Joseph C. R. Licklider as a contribution to the public debate around the anti-ballistic missile ABM system, a complex project which contemplated the development of enormously sophisticated software and eloquently titled Underestimates and Overexpectations. In his paper, Licklider provides a vivid picture of the gap between the military's goals and their achievements. He declares, left bracket 81 time, at least two or three dozens complex electronic systems for command, control and slash or intelligence operations were being planned or developed by the military. Most were never completed. None was completed in time or within the budget. Licklider, 1969, 118. Even more importantly, Randell adds the following comment. I still remember the ABM debate vividly, and my horror and incredulity that some computer people really believed that one could depend on massively complex hardware and software systems to detonate one or more H-bombs at exactly the right time and place over New York City to destroy just the incoming missiles rather than the city or its inhabitants. Randell, 1979. 5. www.culturemachine.net 113 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Here Randell's horror at the excessive self-confidence of some software professionals stems from the connotative association between technology, catastrophe and death in a Cold War scenario. As we shall see in a moment, horror, a powerful emotion, is the result of the anticipation of the consequences of technology, combined with awareness of its intrinsic fallibility. However, by the late 1960s, large-scale systems were not unique to the military scene. Computer manufacturers had started to develop complex operating systems. Specialized real-time systems were also being developed, such as the first large-scale airline reservation system, the American Airlines Sabre system. The costs incurred in developing these systems were immense, and they were very much in the public's eye. Moreover, some of these systems, such as TSS/360 and even IBM/360, kept performing poorly notwithstanding the vast amount of resources lavished on them by their manufacturers, and the professionals involved in these projects felt the pressure of the public opinion. The Garmisch Conference report was produced expressly to serve as an instrument for managers of the private and public sectors and policymakers to anticipate and evaluate the consequences of technology in time. The participants in the Garmisch Conference viewed society at large as mainly concerned with the problem of the reliability of software and with its costs, and they measured the relation between software and society in terms of impact. And yet, and this is an extremely important point for the investigation of software failure, it is precisely this opposition between society and technology that seems not to hold everywhere in the Garmisch report. For instance, participant E. David describes the process of software growth, according to the report, in the following terms. In computing, the research, development, and production phases are often telescoped into one process. In the competitive rush to make available the latest techniques, such as online consoles served by timeshare computers, we strive to take great forward leaps across gulfs of unknown width and depth. In the cold light of day, we know that a step-by-step approach separating research and development from production is less risky and more likely to be successful. The situation is familiar in all fields lacking a firm theoretical base. Thus, there are good reasons why software. www.culturemachine.net 114 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Tasks that include novel concepts involve not only incalculated, but incalculable risks. Norampersand Randell, 1969. 15 F. David focuses here on the pace of software growth. The competition between computer manufacturers forces software professionals to confuse telescope research and production, which should remain separate. Therefore, the uncertainties, which are typical of research here intended, as the development of innovative software spread to production. David's metaphor opposes leaps to steps. The leap is for him a dangerous way to move forward, motivated by the lack of knowledge. The step-by-step approach would be a safer way, not to slow down the growth of software, but to make the speed of such growth more manageable. One must be reminded once again here that the participants in the Garmisch conference had to face some major doubts concerning large-scale software systems. Were such systems actually feasible? In David's terms, the question could have been reformulated as follows: was the speed of software growth actually manageable? Importantly, David's statement attributes the need for taking big leaps forward to the lack of a firm theoretical basis. In other words, the inability to estimate the feasibility of a software project in a reliable way leads to the impossibility of carrying it out step by step, and ultimately to its failure. The failure of a software project then seems to be related to the failure of the management of time. According to David, software professionals are fundamentally concerned not just with risk, that is, the possibility of failure, but also with uncalculated and incalculable risks. It seems quite understandable that certain risks cannot be calculated due to the lack of accurate knowledge. What is really surprising, though, is David's use of the expression incalculable. It is not quite common for software professionals, and for engineers in general, to acknowledge that a technical project involves incalculable risks. Although the participants in the Garmisch conference must not have been aware of this fact, the concept of the calculability of time has a distinct Heideggerian echo. 6. I will come back to this point in a moment. However, for David, the concepts of risk and calculability are both related to the future. Estimates are the expression of a calculability of the future. They actually presuppose the calculability of the future. And it is precisely this faith in the calculability of time, and therefore in the feasibility of software projects, that is put into question in the Garmisch report as well. www.culturemachine.net 115 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. As in the narrative of the software crisis, is the source of technological horror. At this point, I want to posit the following question. To what extent can the incalculability, which is lamented by David, be linked to the unforeseen consequences that for Jacques Derrida are always implicit in contemporary technology? One must be reminded here how, in a dialogue with Bernard Stiegler published in Ecographies of Television, Derrida argues that the acceleration of technological innovation in the contemporary world constitutes a practical deconstruction of the instrumental conception of technology. Derrida, Ampersand, Stiegler, 2002. 45. It is true that in the contemporary world technological innovation is massively appropriated by multinational corporations and nation-states by means of their research and development and defense departments, and that technological innovations are constantly programmed to support economy. But it is also true that technological innovation still gives rise to unforeseen effects. Derrida even propounds that the greater the attempt to control innovations, the more unforeseeable the future becomes. Such unforeseen effects ultimately deconstruct the understanding of technology as merely instrumental, as well as the perception of the human as separate from his tools and a master of them. But in what way did the participants in the NATO conferences explain the incalculability of technology? The Garmisch conference report is dominated by widespread recognition that the 99% of software systems worked as Jeffrey R. Buxton states, tolerably satisfactorily 15. Only certain areas were viewed with concern. Kenneth W. Collins comments, the basic problem is that certain classes of systems are placing demands on us left bracket software professionals right bracket, which are beyond our capabilities and our theories and methods of design and production at this time. There are many areas where there is no such thing as a crisis or routines, payroll applications, for example. It is large systems that are encountering great difficulties. We should not expect the production of such systems to be easy. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 16. www. Culture Machine. Net 116 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. We already know that the risky classes of systems are large scale and real time ones. Nevertheless, this passage seems to take the argument a step further and relate the incalculability of software development to certain demands posed by society that go beyond the technological capabilities of the time. In other words, not only did the conference participants feel the pressure of social demands on them, they also felt that software development reached its point of crisis when society pushed the boundaries of state-of-the-art technology. But did these demands come from society or from technology itself? Here I want to make the suggestion that such a question is at work in the whole of the Garmisch report, and that it silently destabilizes the separation between the technical and the social. Actually, it is precisely when dealing with the issue of the responsibility for the technological risk that the conference participants seem to be confronted with the impossibility of separating technology from society. For instance, Asher Opler states, "I am concerned about the current growth of systems, and what I expect is probably an exponential growth of errors. Should we have systems of this size and complexity? Is it the manufacturer's fault for producing them, or the users for demanding them? One shouldn't ask for large systems and then complain about their largeness." Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 17. Opler's passage is intriguingly ambiguous. He asks whether the responsibility for the rate of the growth of technology must be attributed to the users or producers of technology. The undecidability of this dilemma leaves its mark on the field of software engineering, and especially in its relationship with technological failure. On the one hand, the participants in the Garmisch conference seem to acknowledge that risks are implicit in software, and that software fallibility is unavoidable. This is what David and Fraser state. Left bracket PARTICULARLY, alarming is the seemingly unavoidable fallibility of large software, since a malfunction in an advanced hardware software system can be a matter of life and death. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 16. On the other hand, it is claimed that risks can be avoided if an appropriate and effective theory of the development of software was to be produced. From this latter point of view, the approach to software development must be systematic, Shaw, 1989, and therefore it must become a form of www. Culture Machine. Net 117 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Engineering. However, these two points of view are entangled, and one does not exist without the other. As a result, Stanley Gill concludes, left bracket IT is of the utmost importance that all those responsible for large projects involving computers should take care to avoid making demands on software that go far beyond the present state of technology, unless the very considerable risks involved can be tolerated. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 18. This quotation might sound like an attempt to discharge the responsibility for technological risk on society. In fact, it requires deeper analysis, since in what way could policymakers evaluate risks that they do not know? Software professionals are the ones who are expected to have such knowledge. A Habermasian answer might suggest that policymakers should be better informed of technological risks and able to discuss them freely. Habermas, 1991. But what Gill is actually saying here is that society shall not make demands that can be met only by exceeding the current state of technology. Here we are confronted with one of the points of opacity, as Derrida, 1980, would have it of the foundational narrative of software engineering. What Gill means here is that society needs to take responsibility for an incalculable risk. The real problem here is the incalculability of the speed of technological growth, that is, of the rate at which the state of technology is exceeded. In sum, at the end of the 1960s, software engineering, as a discipline with a theoretical foundation, is called for in order to avoid the unavoidable fallibility of technology, a fallibility that constitutes the risk posed by technology, or better, technology as a risk. This point of opacity suggests that software engineering establishes itself as a theory of technology by expelling fallibility from technology, but such a fallibility, the unexpected consequences of technology, is intrinsic to technology itself, and is exactly what allows software engineering to exist, that is, the reason why software engineering is called for. In other words, software engineering performs an impossible expulsion of constitutive failure from technology, while simultaneously establishing itself as a discipline with this move. Since such an expulsion is performed through the calculation of time, it can also be said that in software engineering the www.culturemachine.net 118 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Calculability of time is undone in its very constitution. Going beyond Stigler's concept of the disadjustment between technology and society, Stigler, 2003, I also want to suggest that society is instituted in the Garmisch report as that which places risky demands on technology, while at the same time, the report declares technology as constitutively fallible, as something that intrinsically incorporates unforeseen consequences. Therefore, the projection of the fallibility in society, that is, on the demands that society poses to technology, is the way in which the conference participants both assume and discharge responsibility for the technological risk. They cannot actually maintain the boundary between technology and society, because this boundary keeps becoming undone. This is why I said earlier that in Heideggerian terms, Randall's horror is the result of anticipation plus the fallibility of technology. In a way, it can be said that, contrary to Heidegger's understanding of the relationship with death as constitutive of a temporality which is more authentic than the temporality of calculation, in software engineering the question of death, for instance, the death of New York's inhabitants, caused by a ballistic device gone wrong, is dealt with as a problem of calculation. Are you experienced? Clumsy users and dumb-proof technologies. In the Garmisch conference report, the user makes its appearance as a problematic figure towards whom software developers have ambivalent feelings. On the one hand, J. N. P. Hume suggests that designers must not overreact to individual users, that is, in order to develop an effective and usable software system, they must identify the requirements common to majority of users and focus on them, nor ampersand Randall, 1969. 40. On the other hand, J. D. Babcock argues for the intelligence of the users. He comments, left bracket THE users are the people who do our design once we get started. 40. In doing so, Babcock awards the users an essential role in the process of software development various decades before the emergence of cooperative human-computer interface HCI. 7. However, the conference participants express a general discomfort about interacting with the user. Manfred Paul describes the user as someone who does not know what he needs, but he couples this with another kind of ignorance. Users are actually cut off from knowing what is or what might be available. 40. And Alperlis adds, almost all users require much less from an operating system than is provided. 40. In these two passages, users are understood. www.culturemachine.net 119 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Alternately, is unable to understand their own needs, and thus unable to pose clear requests to technology, and as overwhelmed by the technological offer, and thus incapable of making the most of the functionalities provided by technology. These complaints about users are a familiar feature not just of software engineering, but also of the general approach of software developers to their non-technical counterparts. See, for instance, Boulter, 1984. However, it would be reductive to interpret such complaints merely in terms of the difficulties encountered by software practitioners in communicating with non-technical users. Importantly, J. W. Smith notices that designers usually refer to users as they, them, nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 40, a strange breed, living there in the outer world, knowing nothing, to whom nothing is owed. He also adds disapprovingly that most designers are designing for their own benefit. They are literally playing games. 40. They have no conception of validating their design, or at least of evaluating it in the light of potential use. 40. This representation of the user as someone out there, someone whose needs should be taken into account in order to validate software instrumentally, is particularly relevant if we are to understand how the figure of the user operates in software engineering. In fact, I want to suggest that the user and their needs are part of a narrative that institutes a fictional origin of the software system. As I have shown earlier on, in the Garmisch Conference Report, society is the locus of a projection of the demands that are supposedly made of technology. Similarly, when conceiving a software system, software engineers understand it as the solution to some pre-existing problem, which is projected in the world out there in order to justify the existence of software. Here I want to emphasize that the figure of the user plays an analogous role, that is, the user's needs are part of a narrative that software developers construct in order to justify the system they are developing. This is not to say that users do not really exist, or that they do not express their demands in terms of what functionalities should be provided by a software system. In fact, the Garmisch Conference report takes communication with users very seriously at all levels. And yet, what I want to point out is that the figure of the user is positioned by the report outside the process of software development in a constant and incomplete movement of expulsion of certain characteristics of software as user needs. In Goose words, software developers need to filter the recommendations coming from the outside. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 41. A double. www. Culture Machine. Net 120 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Strategy is at work here, which acknowledges the importance of users while focusing on how to keep them at bay. Randell even laments the amount of time wasted in fending off the users. 41. Thus, the user is both constituted and neutralized, while it is acknowledged that software development is set in motion by the very existence of potential users and that it needs their feedback. The very development of the software system acts as a form of containment of the supposed user's exigencies. Even more importantly, the figure of the user is associated with the so-called extensibility of software. According to Letelier, a software system should be extendable or open-ended, thus allowing its developers to modify it in the future. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 38. Moreover, as H.R. Gillette points out, documentation commonly referred to as user manuals must be provided to users whose goal is to train, understand, and provide maintenance. 39. User manuals are what enables users to enter an active relationship with software. Ultimately, they allow users to engage with a system whose open-endedness is inscribed in code. Therefore, documentation also constitutes a point where the capacity to take advantage of such open-endedness and to take the system into an unexpected direction is ultimately handed over to the users. This does not mean that any user can actively reprogram any system. In fact, according to the Garmisch Conference report, one of the aims of software developers is to make the system dump-proof, that is, robust and resilient enough to resist improper uses on the part of inexperienced and non-technical users. Nor ampersand Randell, 1969. 40. And yet, it seems to me that the figure of the user is the locus where the instrumentality of software is both reasserted by implicitly defining it as a tool to be used, and opened up to unexpected consequences. The user is actually a name given to a part of the process of software design. It is a field of forces that both constitutes the process of software development and destabilizes it through practices which are potentially characterized by ignorance, impropriety, and the threat of failure. In the figure of the user, the instability of the instrumental understanding of software and software's capacity for escaping instrumentality through the unexpected consequences it generates become apparent. Even more importantly, the ambivalent figure of the user will be at the core of many unexpected developments of software engineering in the 1980s and 1990s. www.culturemachine.net 121 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. A malfunction is a decision. Any tool should be useful in the expected way, but a truly great tool lends itself to uses you never expected, writes Eric Stephen Raymond in his article of 1997, titled The Cathedral and the Bazaar. This article, republished online many times, constitutes the Bible of software engineering for the open source movement. It was conceived by Raymond as an answer to Frederick Brooks' Classical Manual of Software Engineering, The Mythical Man-Month 1995, which was published in 1975 and which still remained influential in the 1980s. The title of Raymond's article is actually a pun on Brooks' famous metaphor of software development as a cathedral. In 1975, Brooks was still very much preoccupied with time management, especially in relation with organization of large groups of programmers. MOST programming systems, he muses in his book, reflect conceptual disunity far worse than that of cathedrals, albeit they did not take centuries to build. Brooks, 1995. 42, and yet, such disunity does not arise from a serial succession of master designers, but from the separation of design into many tasks done by many men. 42. Brooks' main point here is that conceptual integrity is the most important consideration in system design. 42. A software system needs to reflect one set of design ideas. 42, and for this reason software design needs to be structured hierarchically, so that a small group of designers is in charge of all the conceptual decisions, which a larger group of programmers will then implement into code. Although a detailed discussion of Brooks' argument would be outside the scope of this article, it is worth noting that, in his theory of software engineering, Brooks attempts to control at least part of the unpredictability of software through the hierarchical organization of its development. According to Raymond, Linus Torvald developed Linux according to a very different methodology. 8. Raymond contrasts the two models of the cathedral and the bazaar, where the cathedral model is common to most of the commercial world, while the bazaar model belongs to the Linux and the open source world. What Raymond calls the cathedral model is in fact software engineering, as conceived by Brooks, that is, quite a consolidated discipline with its own established corpus of technical literature. Raymond argues that the two models of the cathedral and the bazaar are based upon contrary assumptions about the nature of software development, and particularly of software debugging. www.culturemachine.net 122 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Software debugging is a late stage of software development, and is part of what in software engineering is generally called test phase. Somerville, 1995. Before being released to commercial users, a software system needs to be tested. Namely, it is necessary to verify that the system meets its specifications, or once again, that it works as expected. One of the activities involved in testing is debugging. When a test reveals an anomalous or unexpected behavior of software, code must be inspected in order to find out the origin of the anomaly, namely, the particular piece of code that performs in that unexpected way. Code must then be corrected in order to eliminate the anomaly. The testing process takes time, because all the functions of the system need to be tested. Furthermore, sometimes the correction of an error introduces further errors or inconsistencies into the system and generates more unexpected behavior. Although in the phase of testing, unexpected behavior is generally viewed as an error, it is worth noting that decisions must still be made at this level. The testing team is responsible for deciding whether the unexpected behavior of the system must be considered an error or just something that was not anticipated by the specifications, since, as we have seen earlier on, specifications are never complete, but that does not really contradict them. Errors need to be fixed by correcting code, but non-dangerous and even useful anomalies can just be allowed for and included in the specifications. Thus, the activity of deciding whether an anomaly is an error introduces changes into the conception of the system in a sustained process of iteration. The complexity of the above process explains why software errors are also called bugs. Although the etymology of the term is uncertain, it hints at the fact that errors are often very hard to find, like the moth that Grasshopper is said to have found trapped in a relay of the electromechanical computer Marconi in 1945, which caused many malfunctions. Locating a bug is hardly a straightforward and unequivocal process. Not only is it necessary to find out what part of code causes a malfunction and to read it in order to find out what mistake has been made in writing it. More importantly, very often no obvious mistakes such as misspellings can be found because the malfunction is the result of the interaction of that piece of code with other pieces of code. Thus, more code has to be inspected, and the process tends to grow exponentially. For this reason, Raymond introduces his famous aphorism that given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Raymond, 2000. Non-PAG. This principle is the foundation of the whole conception of open-source software engineering since the realization of an open-source Culture Machine. Net 123 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Project is a collective task. Simply put, according to Raymond, Torvald maximized the number of person hours thrown at debugging and development, even at the possible cost of instability and the code and user base burnout, if any serious bug proved intractable non-PAG. Raymond's passage shows how in open source, the maximization of productivity is still the aim, but now programmers are prepared to risk the instability of the system, or rather, they have accepted that instability is the fastest way forward. In a way, it can be said that open source programmers feel comfortable with the idea of working on a Stiglerian device that goes faster than its own time. Stigler, 1998, they even use such speed to manage the project itself. Nine, moreover, they are comfortable with software anomalies, malfunctions and failures. For Raymond, it is quite obvious that more users find more bugs, because they all have different ways of stressing the functions of the program, for instance, inventing new uses for it. This effect is amplified when users are co-developers. It could be said that in open source, making demands that exceed the boundaries of technology has stopped being a problem. In fact, making unexpected demands towards software seems to be the only way for software itself to grow. And this is not just because users are now empowered with the capacity for developing the system, something that to some extent they could also do in traditional software engineering, although there were gatekeepers whose role was to fend off users' requests. More importantly, in open source, the development of the software system is explicitly distributed among many individuals who produce many overlapping versions of the system. If the parallel process of the development of the system is fast enough, then the system coordinates itself. I want to suggest that this realization itself can be viewed as one unforeseeable consequence of the software engineering of the 1970s and 1980s. Of course, even open-source software systems need to become stable at certain points in time. Anytime one wants to stop being a developer and starts being a user, one must be able to use the system as a tool. The stabilization of the system coincides with its instrumentalization, or vice versa. Instrumentality merges with www. Culture Machine. Net 124 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Stability in time. And yet, the stabilization is not scheduled. It is not understood as the end of a certain stage of development, which needs to be planned in advance, and for which a deadline is established. In a way, there are no timetables, no deadlines. Stability is something that happens to the system, rather than being scheduled and worked toward. However, as Raymond notices in the above passage, a certain amount of control needs to be maintained over releases. Linux versions are numbered in order for potential users to choose which version to run. They can either run a more stable version which nevertheless might present some anomalies that have not yet been solved, or ride the cutting edge and run a newer version which is likely to have been debugged further and perhaps also enriched by new functionalities, but which for this very reason can give rise to some more unexpected consequences. Raymond's passage attributes to users the capacity for evaluating the risks which are implicit in technology and for minimizing such risks by choosing the more stabilized version of a system. Nevertheless, he has already recognized that software always entails unforeseen consequences, to the extent that a system which is considered stable might actually lead to great surprises. What I want to suggest here is that Raymond's distinction between risky and stable systems shows that decisions regarding technology can and must be made by taking into account, rather than denying, technology's incalculability. The monstrous future of technology. In the documentary The Net, 2003, director Lotz Dambeck shows how obscuring the incalculability of technology leads to setting up an opposition between risk and control, and between good and bad technology, and ultimately to the authoritarian resolution of every dilemma regarding technology. Questions such as, should technology be democratized? Should it be made available to everyone even when it is dangerous? Who decides what is dangerous for whom? Are then addressed by embracing either a policy of control or a deterministic, almost paranoid fear of technology, which is also possibly combined with a Luddite stance. The film explores the complex story of Ted Kaczynski, the infamous Unabomber. A former mathematician at Harvard, Kaczynski retreated to a cabin in the wilderness of Montana in 1971. In 1996, he was arrested by the FBI under the suspicion of being responsible for the attacks carried out between 1978 and 1995 by an unknown individual, nicknamed the Unabomber, against major airlines executives and scientists at elite universities. The film complicates. www. Culture Machine. Net 125 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. The narrative regarding the Unabomber, who was also the author of an anti-technology manifesto and an ultimate figure of resistance for those who oppose contemporary technology as a form of control, by situating him within the complex and contradictory web of the late 20th century technologies. Particularly revealing is an interview with John Taylor, an ex-NASA engineer and an admirer of Norbert Wiener, the founding father of cybernetics, which shows how the idea of calculability and the attempt to expel the unexpected from technology was crucial for early cybernetics. Taylor recounts how ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, was set up in 1958 by the American President Eisenhower with the goal of seeking out promising research projects, in Taylor's words, projects that had a longer-term expectation associated with them. ARPA was instituted after the launch of the Russian space probe Sputnik in 1957, which Taylor characterizes as a great surprise for the United States. The American Department of Defense set up ARPA in the hope that we would not get surprised again, like the Russians surprised us. The ambivalence of the term surprise, as both risk and promise, is obvious, in Taylor's words. The best research projects are the ones which hold the promise of good surprises, which will in turn prevent the enemy from surprising us in a bad way. ARP was therefore meant to domesticate the potential of technology, to surprise us, that is, its capacity for generating the unexpected, by subjecting promising projects to control. Taylor ostensibly embraces such a philosophy of control. When during the interview, Dambeck mentions the Unabomber, a horrified look crosses Taylor's face, and as many of his colleagues, interviewed in the film do, he refuses to speak about Kaczynski, dismissing him as a terrorist, and even comparing the Unabomber's manifesto to Hitler's Mein Kampf. When Dambeck suggests that some people such as the Unabomber might be scared by technology, and asks Taylor what he is scared of, Taylor answers, "I am scared of Al-Qaeda, I am scared of cancer. But if we could find a cure for cancer, we wouldn't be afraid." According to Taylor, fear is a matter of ignorance, of not knowing. By possessing more knowledge, he pronounces via having recourse to a rather curious phrase, "We could prohibit cancer." Taylor's revealing formulation is the ultimate expression of a desire for the technological control over nature and for the complete calculability of the future. The idea of cybernetics as the science of control takes up a new meaning here, one related to prediction, calculation, foreseeability. www.culturemachine.net 126 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. This is particularly intriguing if one considers, as Dambeck does, that one of the participants in the Massey conferences which instituted cybernetics as a discipline, between 1946 and 1953, the psychologist Kurt Lewin, conceived of a project for programming humans to give them an anti-authoritarian personality in order to prevent the possibility of fascism forever. Oblivious to the fact that this would be the ultimate authoritarian gesture, Lewin suggested that cybernetics could control and remap people's subconscious in order to immunize them against totalitarianism and to make authoritarian systems impossible. For him, anti-authoritarianism was first and foremost a matter of calculation as the control of the political future of humanity. Ironically drawn in Lewin's project, Henry A. Murray, one of the fathers of TIDS assessment centers, devised a series of tests which were supposed to highlight concealed psychological tendencies by penetrating consciousness with non-surgical means, basically LSD and other drugs. Such tests were carried out by the CIA in the late 1960s at Harvard in a group of talented young male students, among whom was Ted Kaczynski. Whether those experiments led Kaczynski to the fear of occult forms of mind control and ultimately resulted in his paranoid terror of technology is a possibility that the film leaves open. Importantly, however, Dambeck's film makes a suggestion that control and incalculability, risk and opportunity, are constitutive of technology. As Dambeck himself states, the key to Kaczynski's tragedy is the fact that he is part of a system from which there is no escape. He does not understand that, even isolated in a forest cabin, one is still part of the technological system. A cabin is a form of technology, after all, and that there is no outside of technology. Once again, I want to emphasize here that in order to make responsible decisions about technology, one must be aware that technology, as well as the conceptual system on which it is based, can only be problematized from within. This is precisely what the search for the points of opacity of technology allows us to do, stepping out of a conceptual system by continuing to use its concepts, while at the same time demonstrating their limitations. Derrida, 1980. This process of the problematization of technology is creative, productive, and politically meaningful. In fact, it shows that since not everything in technology can be thought or fully conceptualized within one consistent framework, and since points of opacity always remain, technology also always brings about unexpected consequences. www.culturemachine.net 127 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Perhaps the most important point of opacity that emerges from such a problematizing reading is the conceptualization of technology in terms of instrumentality. As we have seen, a sustained attempt to define software as instrumental can be found in software engineering. Such a definition presupposes that software is controllable, that its development and uses can be planned, and that the risks and consequences implicit in software can be foreseen. Broadly speaking, this concept of software is based on the Aristotelian idea that technology is a tool that must be mastered by humans to pursue certain ends, a concept that constitutes the foundation of the general understanding of technology in the Western philosophical tradition. Consistently with this Aristotelian line of thought, not only is software defined as a tool in software engineering, but it is also conceptualized in terms of binary oppositions, for instance, the one between technology and society, and its development is articulated in linear terms as a controllable sequence of steps. This philosophico-technical conjuncture is what, in the words of Timothy Clark, Derrida understands as the complicity of technology with metaphysics. Clark, 2,248. And yet, as the thinkers of ordinary technicity have shown, technology cannot be fully conceptualized within the Aristotelian framework. Beardsworth, 1996. 10. In fact, the understanding of software as a tool is continuously undone by the unexpected consequences brought about by software, which must be excluded and controlled in order for software to reach a point of stability, but which at the same time remain necessary to its development. 11. As we have seen at the beginning, the snail of monsters versus aliens is the point where the instrumentality of technology undoes itself, because technology is always both a monster and an alien, an instrument and a threat, a risk and a promise. This is the fundamental double valence of the unexpected, as both failure and hope. Like Derrida's pharmacon, technology entails poison and remedy, danger and opportunity. Derrida, 1981. The unexpected is always implicit in technology, and the potential of technology for generating the unexpected needs to be unleashed in order for technology to function as technology. The attempt to control the unexpected consequences of technology is ultimately destined to fail, and yet it must be pursued for technology to exist. For this reason, every choice we make with regard to technology always implies an assumption of responsibility for the unforeseeable. This is the problem that I have started from, namely, the fact that we constantly need to make decisions about a technology which is www. Culture machine. Net 128 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Always, in Stigler's words, somehow opaque. These decisions are profoundly political, and they influence our very existence as human beings, not just as users of tools and machines, but also as beings that co-emerge and co-evolve with technology. If one takes into account the unavoidable opacity of technology, no Habermasian way out of this dilemma can be imagined. Namely, it is not enough for policymakers and citizens to make informed decisions regarding technology. Of course, such decisions are inevitable and necessary, but it must also be kept in mind that not everything in technology is calculable, and that therefore every decision about technology is an assumption of responsibility for something that we cannot actually foresee. And yet a decision must be made, and responsibility needs to be taken. The more ethical decisions are the ones that take into account, or at least do not mask, this dilemma, and that give account of their own reasons. By opening new possibilities and foreclosing others, our decisions about technology also affect our future. Thus, making responsible decisions about technology becomes part of the process of the reinvention of the political in our technicized and globalized world. Rethinking technology becomes a form of imagining our political future. End notes. 1. Ostensibly, the film here taps into the popular tradition of superheroes that has dominated American comic books for decades and that has subsequently crossed over into other media. The so-called origin stories associated with superheroes, which explain the circumstances by which the characters acquired their exceptional abilities, often involve experiments gone wrong. See, for instance, Reynolds, 1994. 2. Judith Halberstam has been recently constructing a queer archive of 3D animated features Halberstam, 2007, where the term queer means that such features incorporate a politically subversive narrative, which is cleverly disguised in a popular media form aimed at children. For instance, according to Halberstam, the CGI animated film of 2003, Finding Nemo, depicts the title character, a motherless fish with a disabled fin, as a disabled hero, and links the struggle of the rejected individual to larger struggles of the dispossessed. Nemo leads a fish rebellion against the fishermen. Halberstam proposes the term Pixar Vault to indicate movies depending upon Pixar technologies of animation and foregrounding the themes of revolution and transformation. For her, the Pixar Vault. www.culturemachine.net 129 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Films use the individual character as a gateway to stories of collective action, anti-capitalist critique, group bonding and alternative imaginings of community, space, embodiment and responsibility. Halberstam, 2007. Non-PAG. In a sense, it could be said that the monsters in Monsters vs. Aliens yield themselves to a queer idiom. Actually, queer references seem to have become quite commonplace in animated features. For instance, The Missing Link is a parody of excessive masculinity. Notwithstanding his machismo and his gung-ho attitude to fight, he is comically out of shape and has a gay bond with Insectosaurus. The monsters perform part of their first battle against Galaxar on a stolen San Francisco bus, directed to the Castro, and even more tellingly, the transformation of Susan into a monster frees her from all heterosexual social expectations and places her in a queer alliance within other social outcasts. Nevertheless, it is debatable whether the narrative of the film can be read as subversive, since the monster's community seems not so much to constitute an alternative to the mainstream society as a weapon in the hands of the American government, although one could argue that such subversive narratives are at their most intriguing when they are apparently neutralized. As I will show in a moment, the neutralization of the monsters in Monsters vs. Aliens is in fact only revealed as apparent if one focuses on their relationship with technology. In fact, the incest taboo appears to be neither completely natural nor totally cultural, thus constituting the point of opacity of structural anthropology. In turn, in Derrida's words 1980, a point of opacity is a concept that escapes the foundations of the conceptual system in which it is nevertheless located, and for which it remains unthinkable. For Derrida, in every conceptual system, we can detect a concept that is unthinkable within the conceptual structure of the system itself. Therefore, it has to be excluded by the system, or rather, it must remain untaught to allow the system to exist. A deconstructive Redon looks for points of opacity, that is, for points where the system undoes itself. For instance, a deconstructive Redon of a specific instance of technology would therefore need to ask, what is it that has to remain untaught in order for such technology to exist? www.culturemachine.net 130 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. For the report of the first NATO conference on software engineering, held in Garmisch from 7th to 11th October 1968, was edited by Peter Knorr and Brian Randell soon after the conference. NATO was in charge of the actual printing and distribution, and the report became available 3 months after the conference, in January 1969. Knorr ampersand Randell, 1969. The report of the second conference, held in Rome from 27th to 31st October 1969, was edited by John Buxton and Brian Randell, and published in April 1970. Buxton ampersand Randell, 1970. Both reports were later published in book form. Buxton, Knorr ampersand Randell, 1976. In 2001, Robert M. McClure made both reports available for download in PDF format at http://homepages.cs.ncl.ac.uk/Brian Randell/NATO/. The pagination of the PDF version slightly differs from the original printed version. All the references made in this article are based on the original pagination. 5. In the late 1960s, the unit of measure for determining whether a system was large was the number of lines of code it contained. A large software system could include several thousands of lines of code. Another popular unit, still used nowadays, was the man year, that is, the number of years an average programmer would spend on the system if he or she were to develop that system by themselves. A few years after the Garmisch Conference, a subunit of the man year, the man month, became the title of the classic of software engineering, Frederick Brooks' The Mythical Man Month, 1995. 6. Heidegger's understanding of technology is in turn deeply connected to his philosophy of time. For Heidegger, 1977, modern technology is a form of calculation, and calculation has its roots in our relation to the future, and in our attempt to determine future possibilities, which we fear precisely because they appear indeterminate. Heidegger describes this process as anticipation or concern. Our attempt to control the uncertainty of the future creates the basis for calculation. Understood in a broader historical context, this is what Heidegger identifies as the turning of Western thought into calculation in the modern age. This is also why, for Heidegger, technology has a central role in defining modernity. 7. HCI technologies aim at facilitating the use of computers by human beings. They presuppose a certain model of the user that has been criticized, for instance, by Matthew Fuller, 2003. Fuller highlights the narrowness of the model of the user embedded in www.culturemachine.net/131. Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. HCI, which he understands as functionalist. Fuller, 2003. 13. Are represented in terms of functions performed of tasks and efficiency. Fuller is critical of such idealization of the user and argues for a shift from the model of the individualized user typical of standard HCI towards different approaches, such as participatory design, where users provide continuous feedback to programmers in a process of cooperative design, and in general, to some more critical or even subversive understandings of software. And yet what I want to point out in this article is that the emergence of the user in the Garmisch Conference report shows how the possibility of getting important feedback from the users has always been present in the theories and practices of software engineering, and that the user is inscribed in these theories and practices not just as an idealization or a function of the system, but as a constitutive force within the process of software development. 8. Linux is a Unix-like operating system, started in 1991 by Linus Torvald. It is one of the most famous examples of open-source software. 9. According to Stiegler, contemporary technology is particularly difficult to understand because it has a totally new relation with time. He expresses this fact with the image of a technological device that goes faster than its own time. Stiegler's favorite analogy is that of a supersonic device, quicker than its own sound, whose breaking of the sound barrier provokes a violent sonic boom, a sound shock. Stiegler, 1998. 15. 10. I am referring here to the alternative, non-Aristotelian tradition of thought on technology that starts with Martin Heidegger and includes Jacques Derrida and Bernard Stiegler, among others. Timothy Clark, 2000, calls this the tradition of originary technicity, a term he borrows from Richard Beardsworth, 1996. This term assumes a paradoxical character only if one remains within the instrumental understanding of technology. If technology were instrumental, it could not be originary, that is, constitutive of the human. Thus, the concept of originary technicity resists the utilitarian conception of technology. The thinkers of originary technicity point out that technology is actually constitutive of philosophy, since by providing the support for the inscription of memory, it allows for transcendence, and therefore for thought. 11. I want to emphasize at this point that these observations are not automatically valid for all software. Every instance of software needs www. Culture Machine. Net 132 Flobetti. Does it work? CM112010. To be studied in its singularity, and problematized accordingly. What is more, the opacity of software cannot be dispelled merely through an analysis of what software really is. For instance, by saying that software is really just hardware. Kittler, 1995. Rather, one must acknowledge that software is always both conceptualized according to metaphysical framework, and capable of escaping it, and the singular points of opacity of singular instances of software need to be brought to light. References. Birdsworth, R. 1996, Derrida and the Political, New York. Routledge. Boulter, J. D. 1984, Turing's Man, Western Culture in the Computer Age, London. Duckworth. Brooks, F. P. 1995, The Mythical Man Month. Essays on Software Engineering, 20th Anniversary Edition. Redding, Ma. Addison, Wesley. Buxton, J. N. Norpy, Ampersand, Randall, V. Eds, 1976, Software Engineering. Concepts and Techniques, New York. Petrocelli, Charter. Buxton, J. N. Ampersand, Randall, V. Eds, 1970, Software Engineering Techniques. Report on a conference, sponsored by the NATO Science Committee, Rome, Italy, 27th to 31st October, 1969, Birmingham. NATO Science Committee. Clark, T. 2000, Deconstruction and Technology, in N. Royal Ed. Deconstructions. A User's Guide, Basingstoke. Palgrave, 238-257. Derrida, J. 1976, Of Grammatology, Baltimore. The Johns Hopkins University Press. Derrida, J. 1980, Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences, in Writing and Difference, London. Routledge, 278-294. Derrida, J. 1981, Plato's Pharmacy, in Dissemination, Chicago, Ill. University of Chicago Press, 63-171. WWW. Culture Machine. Net 133 Flobetti, does it work? CM112010. Derrida, J. 1985, Letter to Japanese Friend, in R. Bernasconi, Ampersand, D. Wood, Eds, Derrida and Difference, Warwick. Pereza Press, 15. Derrida, J. Ampersand, Stiegler, V. 2002, Echographies of Television. Filmed Interviews, Cambridge. Polity Press. Fuller, M. 2003, Behind the Blip. Essays on the Culture of Software, New York. Autonomedia. Galloway, A. 2004, Protocol. How Control Exists After Decentralization, Cambridge, Ma. MIT Press. Habermas, J. 1991, The Theory of Communicative Action, Cambridge. Polity Press. Halberstam, J. 2007, Pixar Revolt. Animation and Revolt, Flow Journal 66. Nonpag. http://float.org/p=739. Hansen, M. 2004, Real-Time Synthesis and the Difference of the Body. Technocultural Studies in the Wake of Deconstruction, Culture Machine 6. Nonpag. http://www. Culture Machine. net/index:\\\\article/view/9/8. Heidegger, M. 1977, The Question Concerning Technology, and Other Essays, New York. Harper and Row. Kittler, F. 1995, There Is No Software Theory. Nonpag. http://www. Theory. net/articles. ASPXID=74. Licklider, J. C. R. 1969, Underestimates and Overexpectations, in A. Chase, Ampersand, J. B. Wiesner, Eds, ABM. An Evaluation of the Decision to Deploy an Anti-Ballistic Missile System, New York. Signet, 118-129. McKenzie, A. 2003, The Problem of Computer Code. Leviathan or Common Power. Non-PAG. Blanks. AC. UK/staff/Mackenzie/papers/code/Leviathan. PDF. Manovich, L. 2008, Software Takes Command, http://lab. Software S2Ds. com/2008/11/softbook. HTML. Norpy, Ampersand Randell, B. Eds, 1969, Software Engineering. Report on a conference, sponsored by the NATO Science Committee, Garmisch. www. Culture Machine. Net 134 Flabetti, does it work? CM112010. Germany, 7th to 11th October, 1968, Brussels, Belgium. NATO Scientific Affairs Division. Randell, B. 1979, Software Engineering in 1968, Proceedings of the IEEE, 4th International Conference in Software Engineering, Munich. 110. Randell, B. 1998, Memories of the NATO Software Engineering Conferences, IEEE Annals of the History of Computing, 21. 5154. Raymond E. S. 2000, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, 1st Monday 3-3. Non-PAG. http://firstmonday.org/open/garap/bin/oya/index. php://fm/article/view/578-499. Reynolds, R. 1994, Superheroes. A Modern Mythology, Jackson, Miss. University Press of Mississippi. Shaw, M. 1989, Remembrances of a Graduate Student, Annals of the History of Computing, Anecdotes Department, 112, 141-143. Shaw, M. 1990, Prospects for an Engineering Discipline of Software, IEEE Software, 76, 15-24. Somerville, I. 1995, Software Engineering Harlow. Addison Wesley. Stiegler, B. 1998, Technics and Time, 1. The Fault of Epimboys, Stanford CA. Stanford University Press. Stiegler, B. 2003, Our Ailing Educational Institutions. The Global Mnemotechnical System, Culture Machine 5. Non-PAG. http://www. Culture Machine. Net/index. 0/0/article/view/258.43. Filmography. Monsters vs. Aliens, 2009, directed by Rob Letterman and Conrad Vernon. The Net. The Unabomber, LSD and the Internet, 2003, directed by Lotz Dambeck. www. Culture Machine. Net 135.